Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The murder trial of Eugene Bear Lincoln ended when he was found not guilty of murder in the fall of 1997 in the courthouse of Ukiah, California. He was acquitted on charges of first-degree and second-degree murder, and with the jury divided 10-2 to exonerate him on the manslaughter charges. Apart from the divisive nature of this criminal trial, it also carried an extraordinary aspect. 7 of the 12 jurors chose to come forward and talk about their responses to what they heard and saw in the courtroom during the trial. Jane Diamond was a member of the jury that decided Mr. Lincoln's fate. She attended every session of the trial and every aspect of the jury's deliberations. She's our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious, talking from her home in Fort Bragg, California, in the fall of 1997. Jane Diamond, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us why 7 of the 12 of you, the jury in the Lincoln trial, have chosen to come forward and talk about what you heard and saw.
Well, I think most of us have two immediate concerns. The first is that we would like to do whatever we can to ensure that Eugene Lincoln is not tried for manslaughter. And the reason for that is that there is not evidence, that would convict him. And we feel that it would waste a lot more time and energy and not move forward into healing and reconciliation that most of us would like to see happen. And that's the second agenda. The first is no manslaughter charges. And the second, to move forward and try to find some common ground between these communities and some kind of healing come out of the whole experience.
Well, let's talk about the healing issue, because that is what has to happen whether there is or is not a second or retrial on the manslaughter charges. How do you see healing being created in this situation?
Well, I personally feel, and I think I speak for many of the jurors also, that one major aspect needs to be Jim Tuso and Aaron Williams, who Aaron Williams is probably gone now at this point, but their statements to the effect that there was a miscarriage of justice in the jury's decision, that somehow there was evidence that we didn't pay attention to, and Aaron Williams, in fact, referred to non-existent evidence in the one article that I read about his comments. When these kinds of comments are made, it leads people that were not present in the courtroom, that did not hear the evidence, that were not part of the process at all, to come to the conclusion that someone must be accountable for Bob Davis's death and that that person should be Eugene Lincoln. Until that line of thought has ceased, there just can't be any healing. We feel, all of us, very sad for Phyllis Davis, for Bob Davis's widow and his family. It's terrible that they lost him. And as long as they're led to believe that there's some kind of evidence showing that murder, premeditation, any of those things, if they believe that to be the case, there cannot be healing until all of that inflammatory rhetoric ceases. And at the press conference last Thursday in Ukiah, both Bear Lincoln and Coralie Simmons and Lucia Lincoln spoke about the need for healing and reconciliation. And I was very impressed with that, their need to move forward and work together and find common ground.
What I find is extraordinary about this situation is that 7 of the 12 jurors are willing to come forward. And before, you were just average citizens in our county who really didn't know much about this case or its background.
Mm-hmm. It is extraordinary. I think it's extraordinary also, and I think most of us are rather shocked to have come out at the end of this and not walk away from it, and instead to keep going and see some bigger issues to address. Indeed, I am just an average citizen. I've lived on the coast since 1984. I've raised my sons here. I did not know very much about the case, and after we were called first in April of last year, the judge then instructed us to not read anything, to not expose ourselves, and I didn't. So basically, we all had had about 6 months of not reading about the case, not listening, not having conversations about it. And so we went into that trial really not knowing the whole story or any of the various stories that people told. And we came out quite convinced of certain things that we want to keep talking about.
What was it that convinced you or that motivated you to be on this radio program, to attend a press conference sponsored by the defendants, to be an activist, something that you weren't before?
Well, frankly, Aaron Williams' comments, as quoted in the Press Democrat on Wednesday, October 1st, led me to go to the press conference October 2nd. He was so disrespectful of the jury, and it really was so misleading in his comments that I felt, and I know other people felt, that we really needed to do what we could to get the real story out to people who were not present in the courtroom.
Can you tell us what he said first, and then what the real story is?
First, he talked about that he just couldn't understand how the jury had not convicted Eugene Lincoln of first-degree murder, and how shocked he was when we did not guilty on second-degree murder. And the one piece that of evidence he cited, and it's non-existent evidence, was that after all, there was a tape of the gunshots, and six of them were Dennis Miller's, and the other two, that an expert had testified that the other two could only have been fired by a gun such as that of Eugene Lincoln. And that is simply not the case. The evidence that we got was that the last six shots were consistent with an automatic, but there was no evidence about the first two shots. And, you know, I could go on and on about the details of the evidence, and I won't do that unless you ask me to, but when I read that statement, and others of us felt this way too, we felt so misrepresented, and that he was deliberately misrepresenting what the case was, that we felt we needed to do what we could to set the record straight as just your average, ordinary citizen going in, doing their civic duty, following the law. There were 100 pages of instructions that we followed very closely, and we wanted to do what we could to get the correct information out.
What is it like to sit as a member of this jury and be told after every session of the court that you can't talk about it, and that you cannot form an opinion? How do you control in your own mind not forming an opinion?
It is very difficult. It is very difficult. And the judge was quite firm with us every single time we left the courtroom, whether it was for a break, a recess, a weekend, or overnight. He told us that every single time. Basically, we received a lot of information, and, you know, since we weren't allowed to speak about this at all, even to our fellow jurors, and certainly not anyone else, we weren't ever able to process all that information that we were receiving. So I didn't necessarily have a hard time not drawing conclusions. I kept looking for the evidence that would convince me of something and not finding it. In my mind, I would be thinking, well, there's this question and that question that haven't been answered. But I think that we all were really careful to do what we could to not draw any conclusions until deliberation.
What happened in the deliberations? How did they come together?
Well, we started deliberations on a Wednesday late morning. And we went into the jury room, and since we had never spoken about the trial in all the time that we had spent together over those 8 weeks of testimony, 7 or 8 weeks of testimony, the first thing really that we did was talk just in general about certain witnesses, certain pieces of evidence, certain questions we had. We did not take a vote right away. We didn't even necessarily say how we felt what the verdict should be. We really just began by talking over all of that testimony. And that took us through the first day. By the second day, we were more focused in on the charges and what we believed had happened. You know, we told the story, the whole story, from several different angles and tried to see what made sense and where we all stood on that. And then we had the weekend. We had a 3-day weekend, which was really good because we needed to get some distance from, I think, from each other and from the never-ending conversation that was going on in that court, in the jury room. And for myself, that whole weekend, it was always present in my mind, the whole scene on that ridge the night of April 14th, 1995, and it just played over and over again. So by Monday, it was quite obvious, and we had taken votes here and there as we went along, and it was quite obvious by Monday where we stood. We had dismissed the murder charges almost immediately. That had happened really on Thursday. There was no evidence of murder.
How did you dismiss those charges? With a vote of the 12 of you or in conversation?
It was not a formal vote. It was a conversation and a consensus of all 12 people trying and reading those instructions. I can't emphasize enough how important those instructions were to us. And so we would go and we read over and over again the description of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, attempted murder, self-defense, and tried to see where the evidence. We went over all the evidence. We looked at everything, talked about each piece of it. We had the photographs up. And by Thursday, it was absolute consensus that murder was not, had not, that there was no evidence of murder.
That was Thursday on day two of deliberations.
Yes, it was.
I'd like to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Jane Diamond, a resident of Fort Bragg, California, who was a member of the Eugene Bear Lincoln murder trial jury, which resulted in an acquittal on first-degree and second-degree murder last month, and a 10-2 vote for acquittal on manslaughter charges. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jane, during the time when the jury listened but could not talk about the opinions that you had and could not form opinions, did certain friendships and a certain leadership or individual evolve as a leader of the jury?
No, I don't think so. It was probably well into the second week before we really all knew each other's names. We talked about, you know, when you're in that jury room as much as we were, and that was quite often because the judge would send us out at various times. We very rarely had a 9-to-5 day. We were in and out of that courtroom, so we would talk about families and, you know, all kinds of things. And I would say that we all, as individuals, had different gifts that we brought into that jury room. But in terms of leadership, I don't think so. I didn't feel that way. I don't know if other people felt that. And then ultimately, we had someone volunteer to be the foreperson, the foreman. So we didn't even have to take a vote or deal with that. We had someone volunteer. And then each one of us participated in the deliberations in our own way.
How was it that two of the 12 of you felt strongly enough for a manslaughter conviction that it ended with a hung jury?
Well, that I still I still wish that we could have gone on and come out not hung, but we finally had to agree that we weren't going to get any further. And the two people who felt very strongly about the manslaughter, actually, I believe what they felt the most strongly about was someone had to be accountable. Eugene Lincoln made the decision to go back on that up on that ridge. The rest of us felt that we would have done the same thing. We would have had to check on our friend. Those two people did not feel that that was a rational decision. They felt if they were in that same place, they would not go and check on their friend. And we pointed out to them that if had he wanted to kill Bob Davis and Dennis Miller, he could have easily done it by sneaking around and ambushing them, and instead he was walking down the road, which doesn't show much thought about trying to kill someone. They never accepted that. They absolutely did not accept that. And even though we read the instructions about state of mind, about self-defense, about the need to, if you have two different stories that are both reasonable, that you must go with the version that supports innocence.
And that's the version that you heard in the courtroom.
Yes, and we had it in front of us. We had all of those instructions in front of us.
Is there anything that would lead you to believe that any member of the jury had information that was obtained outside of the courtroom?
We felt a little nervous about that. And I felt a little more nervous, actually, afterwards, because, of course, I didn't know what they might know and I didn't. But there were some references to, well, after all, Eugene Lincoln was a felon with guns and he shouldn't have had them. And we looked at this person and said, well, we never heard that in the courtroom. We can't consider that. You can't consider that. We don't know if it's true or not. And in any case, it wasn't in evidence. The other person seemed to just have really strong feelings that someone had to be accountable. I do not know that they had any outside information, but they sure had a different attitude than the rest of us.
Why do you think that was?
I'm hesitant. I don't think that I...
Or let me ask you this. Did you ask the other two jurors why they have the different attitude? What did they say about it?
One of them didn't answer. We did ask that, and we really were very puzzled about why they couldn't follow the very clear instructions that we had in front of us, that since both the explanations of self-defense and manslaughter were reasonable, why couldn't they go with the instructions that told us, okay, you have got to go toward innocence, and they wouldn't. And what they kept saying was that they felt that he had made the decision and he had to be accountable for going back up on that ridge that resulted in Bob Davis's death in their minds. They were really, one of them didn't even respond and just sat and looked at us, and the other did try to explain that juror's particular feeling.
I'd like to ask you about the courtroom itself and the effect, if any, of the presence of the sheriff and Mrs. Davis and the Lincoln family members and many members of the community present in the courtroom. Did that affect the jury in any way?
I don't believe so. I personally was not sure which one of the spectators was Mrs. Davis, and I hadn't really known who Sheriff Tussaud was, and then I finally sort of figured it out. And again, I also didn't know who the family members of Eugene Lincoln were. I had no idea really of who the individuals were in the courtroom. Most of the jurors really just paid attention to the lawyers and the witness. And we didn't make too much eye contact, I think, with the courtroom. So I don't think that it had an effect other than underlining the real importance of doing this right, of really listening, really not making up our minds.
Before the decision, did the jury ever become aware of the fact that the defense part of the trial was broadcast on public radio?
Yes, the judge told us. He told us the day that started.
Did that make any difference?
No. No, that didn't make any difference at all. I'm glad people had an opportunity to actually hear what went on in the courtroom. I think that leads to people being much more informed instead of just reading a summary of it, although some summaries, like Nick Wilson's in the Albion Monitor that I've read since, made me feel like I was right back in the courtroom. They were so accurate. But I was glad people had an opportunity to hear that.
I'd like to talk again about the need for healing that you've mentioned at the beginning here today, and ask you what role, if any, that you could see the sheriff's office and the district attorney's office doing to create healing.
Well, the first thing I think would be to not go forward with a manslaughter trial. I think that's going to keep the wound absolutely open in the law enforcement community, for the Davis family. It's going to open it all up again for them. And frankly, it's going to get nowhere. Any jury is going to come to the same conclusion we did.
If they do go forward, is there any evidence that they could present that would change your mind to vote for a conviction for manslaughter?
No. I'm assuming that we had all of the evidence in terms of the bullet fragment, the sound recording of the bullets. We were very puzzled about the trail of blood, and that was never really pursued. And there's something very unusual about that. There was evidence that just did not hang together in the prosecution's story. I can't imagine any evidence that would change any of our minds.
Why do you think the case was prosecuted in first-degree and second-degree murder with such fervor as it was?
You know, I cannot imagine why it was. The only guess that I would make is that, again, the rather emotional feeling of it was a police officer. One of the people that lost their lives on that ridge was a police officer, and there just was, I think, a great overreaction.
Why?
To that.
Why?
Why was there the overreaction?
Yes.
I don't know. Other than a feeling, I'm afraid to go down that road in a way. I think they felt someone had to be accountable. But in that whole thing, Leonard Peters somehow got lost, and he died on that ridge also. The whole thing was a terrible tragedy. I don't know why they pursued it in such an overstated way, both the way that they started presenting it immediately, their presence in the valley after it happened apparently was quite heavy, and then the murder charges. Why did they do that? Tony Serra asked those questions at the press conference, and I agree with all the questions he asked. Why was this charged as a murder case?
And we don't have answers yet.
We don't have any answers.
After the trial was over, what kind of reaction did you receive from your family and friends and acquaintances for having been a member of this jury?
Overall, people first said, thank you for doing your civic duty, which was very nice to hear. My family and friends were very supportive all the way along, knowing they couldn't talk to me about how I was spending all of my time. And they were happy to hear the details of what we had done and how we had come to that conclusion. There are a few people who have said to me that Bear Lincoln got away with murder. There's a few people that aren't speaking to me. And I think, again, that goes back to the healing of they feel that somebody has to pay, and they don't know the evidence and they don't know the details, nor do they want to. And I think, again, it's important that we go forward and really look at the evidence that was there and that wasn't there.
Jane, as we come to the close of our program, I'd like to ask you how you rank being on this jury in your life experiences.
Oh, this has been a major life experience, and I didn't really expect it to be. I'm still puzzling over how I feel about the whole experience. It was very, very difficult, not only the driving. I drove to Ukiah and back every day, 4 days a week, for 8 weeks. And you know, that gets a little tiring.
Sure.
The living in a vacuum, not being able to speak at all about what was going through my mind, what I was hearing and thinking and all of that. And then those questions, the why questions of why this trial happened the way it did, has had really a deep effect on me and I think on most of those jurors, and that's why we're speaking out. If it hadn't affected us, so we would not be speaking out. And maybe I can give a last image that stays in my mind that was very effective, and that was the last day when people knew we were bringing in a verdict, and we went up to our jury conference room and looked out the side window and saw all of the armed sheriff's people getting our van ready to take us to our car after the verdict, and you know, SWAT team and lots of people with guns and uniforms. And we looked out the front window, and by then there weren't many people out there. They were in the courtroom. But there was an altar out in front, and that's where Bear Lincoln's supporters had been. There was an altar, there were burning candles. And, you know, just the whole difference of approach, that made a deep impression on all of us, I think.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask you the question I ask all of my guests, and that is, very briefly, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, one of the best books that I've read lately is Independent People by Haldor Laxness. It is absolutely a fabulous book. I can't recommend it more highly. It happens the early part of this century in Iceland, and it was wonderful.
Jane Diamond, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Jane Diamond was a member of the jury that found Eugene Bear Lincoln innocent of murder charges when he was on trial for allegedly having shot a deputy sheriff in the fall of 1997. The book that Jane Diamond recommends is Independent People by Haldor Laxness. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.